Hi, Dylan. How's
going? Going well. I suppose we should introduce ourselves. I'm Dylan. Dylan Matthews. I'm a reporter at the Washington Post. I cover economic and domestic policy and sort of related issues.
I'm John Ashley. I'm assistant news editor at politicshome.com. I cover the whole gamut of British politics, but I also specialise in Treasury. Which has been a very interesting brief, especially over the last few weeks. And I think we're going to discuss what's been happening with Barclays Bank here in London and the fixing of the LIBOR rate. Dylan, if you want to lead off the discussion.
Sure. So, yeah, this is where our beats sort of intersect, in that it's a major sort of economic policy problem that has major ramifications for British politics. And so I guess the short version is there's this rate, LIBOR, which is sort of the definitive rate on a lot of assets, most adjustable rate mortgages in the U.S., and certainly most subprime adjustable rate mortgages in the U.S. are set to LIBOR. I think something like $350 trillion in assets worldwide are set to it. Was being manipulated, that since it's self-reported by banks in London, some banks were under-reporting numbers to signal greater health during the financial crisis and also to help themselves in trades before that. So do you want to go into what this is doing in terms of
the landscape? Well, the main sort of aspect of it at the moment, which I think is dominating the headlines, is it's kind of become a battle between Barclays and the Bank of England, because there's been a few accusations flying around that the Bank of England and Whitehall, which is kind of the civil service, senior civil service, lent on Barclays to lower their submissions, because obviously a higher submission meant that the bank was in a weaker state financially. And several people have been called in front of MPs to give evidence in recent weeks, including the Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, and Bob Diamond, who was the Chief Executive of Barclays, but had to resign. And Bob Diamond said he had a conversation with Paul Tucker, who was the Deputy Governor, and Paul Tucker had told him that Barclays didn't have to appear so high, so their submissions did not need to be higher than all the other banks. Bob Diamond then is supposedly communicated this to staff, who went off and fiddled the rates. So this could have real ramifications for the head of the Bank of England as well as for Barclays. I'd also add that Barclays is only really the tip of the iceberg. Every bank, there are five other banks under investigation, so the likes of HSBC, Royal Bank of Scotland, they're all likely to be hit with huge fines as well. I think we're looking at a wholesale change of the entire banking industry in the world's largest financial centre, so you can imagine what the ramifications are going to be like for kind of global finance.
Right, and the reason that it's expanding, my understanding is that so the way that the LIBOR rate is calculated is that it's an average of the rates that mm-hmm. the banks are lending to each other at, and so one bank can't easily manipulate it, that they can skew the average, but not by much, whereas if all of them are skewing it, then they can have some...
Yeah, that's right.
That's right.
I think what's really worth noting is that Barclays were fiddling the rate in order to make their position look better, but they were fiddling their own submissions, but in order to change the whole rate, they would have required a lot of banks working in concert. I mean, it's possible that the trading desks of different banks were working together to make them all seem stronger than they actually were. And the implications for that are just extremely far-reaching. I think there's a very good piece actually today in the Evening Standard, which is a kind of, it's a London newspaper, and it's a free show, and everybody reads it. And this guy is called Hamish McRae. He's a futurologist, I think. He's written some very good books about sort of what he thinks the state of the economy will be in sort of 10 years from now. And he sees several changes in banking. He thinks banks will shrink now. He thinks their loan books will get a lot smaller because they have to hold a lot more capital. He also thinks they'll see a big cultural change. So bankers won't be able to take risks with other people's money. We're looking at more of a, what he calls a more of a fiduciary system, or what Ed Miliband calls stewardship banking.
We were talking about Hamish,
right?
Hamish McRae. Yeah. So do you want to say more about his predictions about LIBOR?
Well, what he said was that because the reputational damage to the banks is so high that, and we're already seeing it actually, a lot of people are withdrawing their deposits from the big banks and putting them into smaller banks. So we have a bank called the Cooperative,
mm-hmm.
Where they put their profits into sort of charitable things. And it was founded as a members organization, so it's right. owned by its own staff. And that's seen a big upturn in business. We have two new banks that are about to come into the market, including one owned by Sir Richard Branson.
Of course.
Yeah. Virgin Money. That's his one. And so we'll have more. Yeah, and he says that not just, I mean, physically the size of their asset books is going to be a lot, the size of their loan book, rather, is going to be a lot smaller because we've got new rules coming in about the amount of money that banks have to keep on their balance sheets.
Mm.
So it's sort of tiers 1, 2, and 3 capital. So banks obviously aren't going to be able to loan as much, which presents politicians with a difficult dilemma because they both want banks simultaneously to loan to small businesses, but also to hold capital.
Right.
So he thinks it'll be far more difficult for people to get mortgages from now on.
Right.
And he also thinks that businesses are going to look to things like bonds rather than loans. And he actually says Nestle did a bond issue the other day. And it cost them less money. Their bonds were cheaper than for the French government.
Really? Wow.
There's some idea of the relative confidence of investors. So at the moment,
right.
They have more confidence in the multinational than they do in the Western government, which is quite interesting to me.
Yeah, people love chocolate.
So that is true. And dried baby's milk.
Yes.
Sorry. Yeah, so that's how things are playing out. We've got a big inquiry into banking coming as well, which will be led by the same guys who questioned Bob Diamond. And tomorrow, actually, we have the governor of the Bank of England will be in Parliament,
right?
Which is going to be a big day. So we'll have even more. This runs and runs. It's not. Barclays was the beginning of a massive scandal. And it will be the tip of the iceberg, I'm afraid to say. I think we'll hit Wall Street as well. I can't see how it can't.
How do you see this playing out? So is this becoming a sort of attack line for labor that sort of the regulators fell on the job? But then again, all of this sort of malfeasance happened during the Brown years, and Mervyn King, I believe, was either a Blair or a Brown appointee. You'd know better than I.
Blair,
yeah. And so is it sort of hitting all sides equally because of that, or?
Yeah, I mean, Martin King is an apolitical figure. Okay. No, you'll be able to say whether or not he was conservative or left wing or whatever. He's been fairly critical of banking himself. The way it played out was that George Osborne, who's the Chancellor at the moment, kept attacking Ed Balls, who was the Shadow Chancellor.
Right.
Because in 2007, Ed Balls was the guy in charge of the city, or he was the city minister, when all of this kicked off. And then George Osborne did an interview, and he said that Ed Balls, he said rather cryptically, that Ed Balls has questions to answer. He didn't really elaborate.
Right.
That became a sort of, that was the political row. It was a tussle between those two. And they really hate each other, which ended the theatre to it.
Right.
Balls got up and said in Parliament, "You should withdraw that. You're impugning my integrity. How dare you?" And Osborne said, "I'm not going to withdraw it. You've done nothing to sneer throughout your career."
Right.
This is known as the arch plotter. Trying to bring down Tony Blair when he was Prime Minister and stuff. So that's the kind of politically, the politician's behaviour has been of a different order to the scale of the crisis. Miliband's response has been a little bit more mature. He gave a speech last week about the kind of banking system we want to have, where he said it needs to be, as I mentioned in the other article, in the Hamish McRae article, it's going to be moving towards more of a stewardship system, so kind of a return to maybe a slightly idealized image of banking in this country.
Right.
Where it's a profession, like you're a doctor or a lawyer or a banker. Right. Whereas banking for a while now, for the last couple of decades, has been seen as a sort of flashy, fly-by-night sort of trade. Not the kind of you trust, not a trustworthy profession. Which is also obviously very toxic,
right,
image of the city. So that's, yeah, I think that's the political ramifications. Labour been pretty, both sides have got things to hide on this. The Tories take a lot of money from the banks, sort of campaign contributions. So you'll see, the Mayor of London, Boris.
Yes.
He did a piece last week where he said Barclays sponsor these bikes, and he said if they give me another £50 million for the bikes, I'll change my name to Barclays Johnson. If you can imagine,
right?
Generally, very few people are sticking up for the banks. It's all politicians getting together to have a go at the banks. More to have a go at the banks than to have a go at each other. Because it makes them better by comparison.
Right.
Politicians held in higher esteem than anyone.
Is there a social... So one of the more interesting sort of aspects of the Cameron administration, at least as an outsider, is sort of that all these people know each other and are of a similar class, that Osborne and Cameron and Johnson were all at Oxford and in the Bullingdon Club and all the rest of it. Is there a sense that one of the major problems in the U.S. is that there's a lot of, that the class from which sort of senators and presidents come is the same as the class from which CEOs of major banks come. And so there's sort of a group affinity there that prevents sort of regulation from happening. Do you see sort of things like that, apart from sort of bike sponsorship?
Just the Conservatives, the top brass of both political parties, born almost entirely from Oxford and Cambridge. There used to be an era where Labour politicians were former trade unionists, so you'd get people who had worked in the mines, who were MPs and ministers. And there are still a few of them, sort of veterans, kicking about. There's a few brilliant sort of old boys on the Labour benches who will just scream at David Cameron. The language is not very parliamentary at times, shall we say.
Sure.
And now we've got where it strikes me that in America the route is very often through law school,
right,
then into politics. In the UK, it's PPE at Oxford, which is philosophy, politics, and economics, which is their flagship course. It's their kind of Masters of the Universe course.
Right.
And then maybe a job as a special advisor in the Cabinet Office or in the Treasury or something like that. So that's what David Cameron did. That's what George Osborne did. That's what Ed Balls did. That's what Ed Miliband did. They all did that. They all went to Oxford. Three out of the four of them did PPE. All of them jobs. They've never had jobs outside politics.
Right.
Except David Cameron. He worked as a PR guy for a TV company. I totally agree. I mean, there's a lot. The kind of people, the governors of the Banks of England and that kind of thing, they're all drawn from the same university as well. Just kind of like, Bob Diamond wasn't really part of that clique.
Right.
It made the difference of selling down the river and have a go. He's a sort of archetype of how English people perceive Americans. Yeah.
Right.
Tiny teeth.
Slick back hair, yeah.
Exactly. He was very, very disingenuous when he was in front of the MPs as well. He kept calling them by their first names, and people found it, they all found it extremely irritating.
Right.
I thought he was doing it deliberately to try and appear kind of folksy.
Right.
And down home. And he did the same thing. He appeared about a year ago, just to discuss banking in general. And he gave this little story about how his great-grandparents had come to America from Ireland, and they were poor, and they'd come on a boat. And one of the MPs said, I'm like, oh, you're bringing a tear to my eye. it is interesting to see how he was treated in terms of, I think he was treated differently because he was American, even though he's actually, he's a British passport holder now. He's a British citizen, I mean.
Right,
So he's done a thing too.
Well, he's not just American, he's sort of a symbol of the American way of thinking, in a way. Like, it seems like the things that he was doing at Barclays, and this is perhaps exaggerated, but the sort of swashbuckling, trading on your own accounts behavior, that is sort of in marked contrast.
Yeah.
Like, rusty, aristocrat, British thing before that.
And another interesting thing, sort of, back, those relative about 1986, we had something called the Big Bang, and before that, American companies weren't really allowed in the City of London, but in October, the big day was October the 27th, 1986, and the Americans came piling into the City of London and brought with them huge wages, huge amounts of money, and a totally different kind of working culture. It might sound quite hard to believe, but before the Big Bang, bankers in London used to take sort of 2-hour working lunches, which involved them getting really hammered, thrashing out deals like that. And apparently people, when the people came over from Wall Street to work in London, they were utterly dismayed by the kind of the old boy clubbiness. It really was. It was who you knew, not what you knew. It was generations of people from the same family. Even at Barclays, seniority, you could only get you could only get so high if you didn't have the right surname.
Right.
But that was all smashed open. And a lot of people now are looking back tonight to the 80s and saying that's what's got us into this problem.
Is that change?
Liberalisation, yeah. And it's easy, I think, for a certain part of the of English society or British society, it's nice to think of a scapegoat. If you think, it all went downhill when the Americans came in.
Mm-hmm.
Fits into a narrative.
Right.
That's something that's kind of becoming we're looking at it a bit more historically now, in those terms.
And we should say, just for American viewers who may not be familiar with the distinction, that the term the City of London refers is not sort of metropolitan London, including all the places where the people live. It's this very specific section in the center where all the financial units are.
That's right. Traditionally, it's known as the square mile because...
So let's pivot from banking specifically to sort of the broader sort of context in which this debate is happening in Britain. The past few years, the coalition has been implementing austerity measures. Do you want to sort of talk about what that's entailed?
Yeah. So it's mainly, so far, it's actually mainly been tax rises, but that's because the majority of the spending cuts haven't actually come in. The ratio for people who are interested in this sort of thing is about 80% spending cuts to 20% tax rises. I should point out that spending rose under Tony Blair and Corbyn. So even after all these cuts, we're still going to be spending around what we were spending in 2007. Mm-hmm. So in the grand scheme of things, it's not particularly huge. Helps that it's been protected, so that's there. But our army has been cut by 20,000 troops. We don't have 100,000. So if our army is being cut, even while we're in Afghanistan,
right?
There's been quite a lot of cuts to welfare. Particularly housing benefit, which is what you get to help you pay your rent. And virtually, there's going to be large-scale losses in the public, job losses in the public sector. And the way it's playing out politically is that, obviously, Labour are accusing the government of responsible for putting the country in a double-dip recession, which we are in now.
Right.
And the government hits back that it's all Labour's fault because they left us such a big budget deficit.
Right.
We had a budget deficit of £150 billion a year when they took office. And the size of our GDP is only about a trillion, so
right.
It was pretty big. I think it was something around 12% of GDP. It was one of the highest in the world. It's an argument that you see all over Europe, and it's especially stark in places like Greece and Portugal,
right?
As you've probably seen on the TV. I mean, we have it nowhere near as bad as they do. Our interest rates, just by way of comparison, are about 1.4% on our government debt.
Right.
It's as low as almost in our history. And Greece, it's about, some of the recent offerings have been about 30%.
Right.
So they basically can't raise money. Whereas we can continue to borrow, which is a good job because we are borrowing another half a trillion pounds in the next 5 years, even with the supposedly savage cuts.
Right.
But politicians don't talk about the headline figures like that because I think they think it'd scare people. And they're probably right.
Right.
And
is the sort of debate over sort of the scale of the austerity is are Labour sort of disputing the need to cut the deficit at all, or is it sort of a sort of your package is shifted in the wrong direction, is cutting the wrong things, has to
yeah it's definitely that. Labour are saying that if they were in government, they'd have to make cuts as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the government's doing it on a scale which is counterproductive. George Osborne set himself a lot of targets for borrowing, and he keeps missing them.
Right.
Which makes easy pickings. He's made himself a hostage to fortune by setting himself up so early in the government, saying, oh, we're going to he pledged to get rid of our entire structural deficit within 5 years, which is tricky.
Right. It's especially tricky when you have a declining economy and tax revenue is falling.
Precisely. And it's, our export market is Europe.
Right.
To an extent. And that is, no one's buying anything.
Right.
Because their own economies are in such a poor condition. A lot of the government's rhetoric now is about how to expand our export markets. So you've seen a lot of ministerial delegations to China, Brazil, Indonesia, Malaysia, where we see kind of growth markets. But interestingly, from perhaps from an American perspective, is that Ed Balls and Ed Miliband, who are the guys at the top of the Labour Party, and to a lesser extent the new French president, kind of set up an international kind of clique of pro-growthers,
right,
in which President Obama is included. So it's the growth guys, as they see themselves, Obama, Miliband, Hollande, versus Angela Merkel, David Cameron, and the Spanish PM, Mariano Rajoy,
right,
who's a right-winger as well. And he's just passed a really pretty tough set of spending cuts of his own.
Right.
And Spain's a really big economy, and it's got 50% youth unemployment at the moment.
Yeah.
Which is pretty shocking.
And 25% general unemployment, right? I think that was the peak of Great Depression unemployment in the U.S. It's really startling figures.
Spain's always had a very seasonal economy. So it's generally been even in the good times, Spain had an employment rate of about 7%, but then manageable.
Right.
Yeah, and Portugal, I was in Portugal not long ago, and it's really... which is unfortunate. So, the country. And the younger guys you spoke to, sort of guys in their 20s, were saying, everybody we know, all the guys who went to uni, they all either have emigrated or are trying to.
Right.
So you're seeing a brain drain. Same Greece, all the wealthy elite have left.
Mm.
So they're finding it doubly difficult,
right,
to raise any revenue for that reason.
Yeah. And it's understandable that if you're in a currency and political union where immigration to pure countries is very easy, and there is still a wide variation and prosperity, that you're going to see things like that sort of to the detriment of national economies.
But I think, again, you're going to see the major European economy just falls flat on its own. I mean, Greece cannot maintain the terms of its deal. It's unrealizable. I mean, it's had 5 years of recession in a row.
Yeah.
It has no means of generating money, and it's got enormous public debt. And the fabric of society is kind of being torn apart as well. I mean, there are people who can't. Interesting to discuss, but I mean, people are going to hospitals in Greece and being told that they can't have their drugs,
right?
Because the hospital doesn't have enough money. Whereas in the United Kingdom is kind of strange because we're not used to paying for medical treatment,
right? Right.
Again, a huge difference between the US and the UK, and likely to be a big battleground come November of this year, I imagine.
Yeah, no, and it's funny because it seems like the exact opposite dynamic plays out in the two countries, and that sort of here you have regular arguments about sort of to accuse someone of trying to make American healthcare like the NHS is a major insult. That it brings to mind sort of rationing and stuff like that. Whereas it seems like in the UK to accuse someone of Americanizing healthcare is a really grave charge.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny to think that the party that sees themselves, well, our Conservative Party, see it as a electoral necessity to say that they have ring-fenced health spending on our National Health Service. Whereas I can't imagine Republicans similarly.
Right.
Yeah. Let me talk about, it's actually not just the UK. I think in terms of Europeans' sort of attitudes to health and the kind of the way the economy works, in France they talk about the Anglo-Saxon model. So they lump the UK and the US in together as a kind of uber capitalist, Gordon Gecko system where the individuals, all accounts and so on. We've got our own big health reforms coming at the moment. And, as you say, when people want to criticize what the government's doing, so bringing in more private companies and stuff to do operations, people say, you're trying to turn us into America. You're going to make a system where people have to pay. The word market is a dirty word in health in Britain and in education as well. The idea of trying to marketize something means inherently you're trying to take it away from the public.
Right. Is the nature of the proposals sort of move toward a voucher model where you have federal subsidy for private insurance, or is it something more subtle than that?
All it is letting, so you have sort of, imagine a hospital has a budget.
Right.
At the moment, or traditionally, you spend all that budget on NHS commissioned operations. But the idea with this is that an individual doctor could choose a company, a private company, to carry out that operation with NHS money. But it's not, it wouldn't involve individuals having an insurance plan. But still give you free at the point of need. That's the sort of phrase. We do have private healthcare. A lot of rich people use that, but they still pay into the NHS.
Right.
So everyone else gets it for free.
Right.
The downside, there are things that you should say in, maybe not in defense of the American system, because it's obviously doesn't cover everyone, which is a pretty big flaw.
Right.
But the NHS has bad infection rates in hospitals, and historically has had quite high waiting times.
Mm-hmm.
So those are definitely, worth taking into consideration.
Right.
When we look at the American, this kind of debate over healthcare is just astounding because we think we're the richest country in the world and still spend so much money on healthcare anyway.
Right.
I don't know, I'm interested from your point of view, it struck us that the Romney plan in Massachusetts is quite similar to what.
Oh, very much so. It's funny that Obama's plan is the bill Obama passed is more or less identical to the one that Romney signed in Massachusetts. It's more or less identical to the plan that the Republicans offered in the 90s as an alternative to the healthcare plan that Bill Clinton presented. It's, I think, significantly more right-wing than the plan that Richard Nixon offered in the early 1970s that was shot down by Ted Kennedy, who wanted a more Canadian-style single payer. And when a Democratic president endorsed what had been a traditionally Republican approach to this, he the issue got repolarized, and you have a point where not many of them are willing to admit this. This guy, Michael Cannon at the Cato Institute, which is a sort of free market, sort of classical liberal free marketplace.
Yeah.
He's started something called the Anti-Universal Coverage Club. People just sort of opposed to the idea that it's the government's job to provide universal coverage to people. But, like, most people aren't that forthright about that, that they'll sort of wave their arms about, other things that you're gonna do. But there are some of the sort of, I think, more thoughtful conservatives than people like David Frum, who's he's a remarkable case in that he's in less than 10 years gone from the guy who coined the phrase "axis of evil" when he was one of Bush's speechwriters to a guy who says, "Look, you know, this was the best we're going to do. We cannot viably oppose any kind of universal coverage. What are we doing?" And it's funny in that I think the reason we haven't gotten something yet, like, given, and like, the perplexing thing is that if both parties have supported universal coverage for like 40 years now at least, why hasn't this happened yet? And I think it's just a question of institutions, that like, there were majorities for some universal plan in the 70s and the 90s.
Yeah.
Even in the 30s and 40s.
Being important as well.
Right. Right. Yes.
I think, having studied American politics a bit, the influence of sort of big money is far, far greater than it is in Western European countries. Not in Eastern European countries.
Right. And of particular interest groups within, like, the first really big push for universal healthcare was, at the same time that you guys got it, that as Clement Attlee was pushing for the NHS, Harry Truman was trying to pass a National Health Insurance Act in the U.S. It got killed both by business, but mainly by the American Medical Association, the main trade group for doctors.
Same here, the BMA, British, for the people opposing the National Healthcare Act.
Mm-hmm.
They oppose the current reforms as well. They seem to oppose everything.
they're like where they're at.
Our doctors went on strike 2 weeks ago.
Really?
Over pensions.
Huh.
The part of the austerity drive has been cutting public sector pensions. And their pensions would have been a miserly £68,000 a year. Which is amazing by the standards of anything here. They went on strike. No general practitioners were at work for a day. They have a union. Yeah.
Huh.
So the British Medical Association is basically a union.
Okay.
A very rich one with some influence.
Right.
Everyone's gone on strike now. They're just joining the club. Head teachers are going on strike. They have a principals union, but.
Oh, I think the principals are covered by the NEA, the sort of normal teachers union. But you guys have.
Yeah. Their teachers earn really good money, and they still went on strike.
I'm actually curious about this. Not to interrupt, but that one of the major consequences of austerity in the U.S. has been so private sector for almost. The private sector unionization rate is very, very low. But there's still a lot
of...
Right. Who are covered by public employees unions. And so one of the major cleavages has been as a way of cutting costs, that in Wisconsin, this was a very big thing of that there were Republicans would try to pass legislation to break up or reduce the collective bargaining power. Scott Walker. And has there been similar pressure for that in the UK, just as a sort of as a structural means of reducing forces pushing for greater public spending?
Yeah, but to a lesser extent.
Mm-hmm.
what are the things that people, that the Conservatives have been pushing for, some of them, is to have a higher threshold for union ballots. So at the moment, they just need a simple majority, but they want to change the law so that they need 50% of their members to have voted in favour of a strike. Because turnout for these strikes is pretty low, which means, I mean, in some cases, we have a union called Unite, which is has 3 million members, I think. That's about right. And their leader got less than 10% of members' votes in their election, for example. And so that's the main... They're not trying to crush the unions, really. They just want, they think they just want to make it more difficult for them to go on strike.
Right.
So it's not, I mean, they're not really kind of trying to disband them or anything like that. The union movement has really, and we're talking about in the 70s and 80s, they were hugely powerful. If you think back to the miners' strike, we're looking at sort of months of industrial disputes. It was like a pitched battle. Police, like, people were killed in the kind of, in the street fights in Wales and places like that. But now, public, unions are far more, you're far more likely to be in a union in the public sector,
right,
than in the private sector. I mean, for example, you can't be in a union if you work for McDonald's in the UK.
Right, here too.
Yeah, they say, oh, well, we just prefer to deal with our staff directly. And as a former employee, I can tell you that that's true. Poorly. But no, I think union bashing is a real great sport for the Tories. They've always loved it. And they've got the ideal people at the top. I mean, we have guys at the top of the major unions in the UK who are... straight up Marxists. They're not just like they're not social democrats. They are Trotskyites.
The old militant folks who have stayed around.
Exactly. I mean, they call the guy the head of Unite, which is the one I mentioned, is known as Red Len. And we had Red Ken, who was the guy who tried to become mayor of London.
Right.
Red Ken Livingstone. He was the mayor of London for a while. And then people call Ed Miliband Red Ed. Because the unions give, he won the leadership because of the backing of the unions.
Right.
Labour has a very strange leadership process where the unions get a certain number of votes, and if their leaders decide to allot them to one candidate, then that candidate gets all of them. A bit like the Electoral College.
Right.
So Ed won like that, even though he lost to his brother in the popular vote.
Right.
So he's called Red Ed by some people. Backing. He's not really. But the guys at the top of the union really are, which makes them sitting ducks for Conservative politicians. And also, some of the union guys have been suggesting that there should be strikes during the Olympics, which you can imagine how that went. That will go down. You know, we'll be looking forward to that. It's been a bit gloomy of late, and it's nice to have these kind of big national
talks.
I think that's, I've discussed sort of actively with a few people, and they think, a lot of people think that that will be going into the next election. That's what the Conservatives here, they're going to focus their attacks on that, on Labour's links to trade union movement, and also on, because they've tried to cut it, and Labour have opposed that, but it's quite popular with the public.
Cutting welfare is.
Yeah, because we have these papers. They're called Quality Dailies, but they're really just rags. And they're called, two of them, one's called the Daily Mail, one's called the Daily Express. And they regularly have front pages about sort of gypsies claiming £3 million off the state, living in mansions at taxpayers' expense and that kind of thing. There's a certain body of the public that thinks that people are living high on the hog without working. I'm rambling a little bit. They brought in a cap, £26,000 a year. So you can't get more than £26,000 a year.
That's a lot of pounds.
No, that's the average salary. That's why they
right.
That, and Labour voted against cap, which is a great. I mean, the Tories were loving that.
Right, it's easy to attack.
Exactly, it's going to have really bad effects for certain people. People with large families are going to be really screwed.
Right.
And there have also someone's done a website called Callum's List. So I'm sure it's a homage to Craigslist, but
sure.
It's actually a list of people who.
No worries.
It's actually people who have killed themselves because their benefits have been cut.
Whoa.
I know. It's a website for that. It's just a list of suicides based on welfare cuts.
Yeah.
Which is really quite scary. And people think, the Tories, this is what they're renowned for, is cutting welfare. That's like their thing as a party. And David Cameron's latest slogan is, we're for the workers, not for the shirkers.
Of course. Well, it's funny since this has sort of died as an issue in the US. There was a very salient one in the 80s and 90s, that sort of, you had Reagan going on about Cadillac queens, that sort of people could afford Cadillacs with their welfare checks. And then Clinton passed a sort of work requirement for welfare. Sort of you can be on for, I think it's 2 years, and if you don't get work after that, sort of you're tough.
Based on Minnesota, isn't it?
Right. Minnesota and Wisconsin, the Midwestern states tried this out and it also sort of block granted it. And so previously there had been this program called Aid for Families with Dependent Children that was centralized. It was set up by Lyndon Johnson as part of the War on Poverty. And one of the things Clinton did was make it a state-level program. But it's funny that it just totally went away. That both the sort of left of Clinton people saying that this was going to lead to a huge increase in child poverty, which, like, it's hard to say, like, child poverty went down, but then again, this was in the midst of a huge economic boom, so you would expect child poverty to go down. And conservatives who sort of thought he didn't go far enough have sort of neglected this, that sort of ever since then, it's just been, it's one of the few issues where, like, it's similar to gun control, like, about 10 years ago, the people who opposed gun control sort of won, and like no one talks about it anymore. And it seems like a similar thing where sort of the people who wanted to cut welfare or at least reform it structurally won that debate, and everyone sort of has made a collective decision to ignore it.
I know, it's strange, especially with guns. It's virtually impossible to find a gun in England. Which makes the US situation, and some people sort of quietly think, oh, I'd love to have a rifle. But, we had similar in the same, in the opposite sense that the debate's closed.
Right.
The only people who allow guns are farmers, to shoot foxes. Although we could use them in the city because I had one in my house the other day. we had a massacre in a Scottish city called Dunblane. Mm-hmm. Which is actually where Andy Murray's from. He was there.
Really?
He was in the, you know Andy Murray's, right?
Yeah.
He was underneath a table while this guy went and he shot a load of kids. And about a week later, they just banned handguns. And that's it. You can't buy a handgun anymore. As of that day.
Yeah.
But I mean, on welfare, I don't know how the sort of spending compares, but it's the biggest spend of the government's outlay is the Work and Pensions Department. It's only slightly ahead of the Health Service.
Right.
But I suppose in America it's defense.
So the big three are defense, Social Security, so old age pensions, and Medicare, sort of old age health insurance. And all the sort of welfare related provisions are sort of tiny compared to that. That the actual welfare program is like, I think like $50 billion a year. It's trivial in the context of the federal budget. The biggest program is actually this thing called the Earned Income Tax Credit that is, in the tax code, that if you have a positive tax burden, it reduces that burden. If you don't have a positive tax burden because you're too poor to be paying income taxes, it will send you a check. But that's tied to you working. Like, if you're not working, you can't get the Earned Income Tax Credit. It's much, 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 much smaller, and like it's a significant, but not sort of, when people talk about cutting the long-term deficit, no one talks about that because it's understood that you can't get any money from it.
Does anyone talk about cutting the, military?
There's surprising amount of talk about that. My colleague, Susie Kim, had a good piece about this today. That the public opinion is actually coming around to cutting defense. And Obama has been making signals in that direction. Some of the fiscal conservatives in Congress have made noises about being supportive of that sort of thing. And in fact, at the end of the year, if nothing changes, as part of one of the budget deals, 20% of defense spending will go out the window just automatically. It's a number. It's still like, I think after that, it will still be more than like every other industrialized nation combined. And I believe that that tally is not inclusive of the cost of the war in Afghanistan. It's sort of fudged. But it is the ground is sort of shifting on that one, in an interesting way.
It's definitely the same. I don't know if there's been any moves towards this in the States, but here the kind of new idea is that we spend more money on our aid budget and less on our military. Right. And that spending money on aid in places like Somalia, Sierra Leone, places that we have historical ties to, will ultimately cost us less in the long run. So we've given quite a lot of aid money to places. So Pakistan, even India still gets aid money from us.
Really? Wow. And they take it.
I know, and they've got a space program.
Yeah.
Before, when this government came to power, China got money off us, which is remarkable, and Russia, but they stopped that. Mm-hmm. So we're quite magnanimous, I think, for a pretty small country. But that's the way the defense, we've always been, I don't know if Americans realize how dependent the UK is on America for its sort of defense infrastructure. We can't really do anything on our own. Our nuclear deterrent, we need the say-so from Washington to fire it. Mm. So it's not an independent nuclear deterrent. The US has bases, nuclear bases in Scotland and the north of England. That's the kind of basis for that. We're getting to the point where we will, in the sort of Western world, the UK and France are really, we're cutting both our respective defense budgets pretty quickly. So right. Might just be America's back in the kind of world policeman role, even while it is reducing its own defense spending.
Right. And this does worry a few people here. There was actually my university commencement speech was by one of the top Democrats in the House, Barney Frank.
I like him. He's funny. Yeah.
He's a very funny man. And the speech was no exception, but it ended with a surprising and forceful call to cut spending with the express intention of signaling to Europe that we're no longer going to be their sort of backup defense.
I love the idea that we bailed you out in World War II idea.
Right.
It's amazing. I don't know about you, but I did Russian at university, and they don't quite see it like that.
I'm sure they don't. No, there's I can tell you that I went to I grew up in a pretty left-wing school district, and we did not hear about who won the European front in World War II, and that that there were many more references to D-Day than to Stalingrad.
You can learn our version of the Second World War is based around the Blitz and
right.
and D-Day and the Eastern Front, Stalingrad. You wouldn't know that it happened.
Yeah. Right.
Genuinely, if you're a sort of 15-year-old, unless you went and took it upon yourself to go and find out, you'd never have heard of it.
Right.
It's just not the version. It's interesting how you learn kind of versions of.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it makes sense as a sort of aftergrowth of, like, obviously during the Cold War, they didn't want the story of World War II to be, we got friendly with the communists and then they killed the fascists.
Stalin.
Right.
Now propaganda. Amazing to think of now. We're looking at the picture right. from Yalta where they all sat next to each other.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing to see now. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
remarkably far from London.
We have. So I think we have a rule in my house that once it gets to Stalin, things are probably should wrap up. But this has been very nice and
hope enjoyed.
Yes. It's been a pleasure. All right.
Okay. Cool. Take care.
Take care.
Bye now.
All the best. Mm-hmm.